This week on COVID, Race, and Democracy.
Let me say to you tonight that whenever you are engaged in work that serves humanity and is for the building of humanity, it has dignity and it has worth.
Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was a prophetic radical voice and a humble servant leader who demonstrated the power of nonviolence and resistance in the face of American apartheid, global capitalism, and militarism.
Dr. King represented a radicalism that was very much threatening to not only the system, but to 75% of white people in America. He was now critiquing capitalism.
San Francisco's retired Secretary Treasurer of International Longshore Association, ILWU, Local 10, Clarence Thomas.
Greatness comes from servitude, from doing something to help other human beings. He said, that is what your greatness comes from, but you have to reorganize your priorities to make that happen. And so he just finally said, look, I'm not going to have a lot of money or luxurious things to leave behind, but I will leave behind a committed life.
And we'll hear from esteemed civil rights activist and Black Studies professor, Dr. M. Tangalizi Sanyika. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Akua Holt. January 15th, 2023 marks the 94th anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s birth. One of the unions that Dr. King was closest to was the ILWU on the West Coast, built out of a struggle for a union hiring hall and against business unionism, which dominated the International Longshore Association, ILA. One of the struggles this union led was the integration of the docks in San Francisco. Now, more than 60% of the members of ILWU Local 10 in San Francisco are African Americans. Clarence Thomas, retired Secretary Treasurer of ILWU Local 10, spoke to Pacifica's Steve Zelter about Dr. King's relationship with the ILWU and his impact on the struggle of workers today.
But I say that the system doesn't kill dreamers. They kill revolutionaries. And Dr. King had a revolutionary spirit and a revolutionary view. He said, we must see the evils of racism, economic exploitation, and militarism are tied together, and you cannot get rid of one without getting rid of the other. He said that in a speech in August of 1967. 1967 was a very pivotal year for Dr. King. And one of the points I'd like to raise is that on September 21st, 1967, some 6.5 months before his assassination, Dr. King spoke at ILWU Local 10. And the occasion was, there was major fundraising going on all across the country. And there was going to be a fundraiser at the Oakland Coliseum featuring Joan Baez and Harry Belafonte. But he said he could not come to the Bay Area and not come to Local 10 because he said that Local 10 had strengthened his struggle. I'd just like to refer very quickly. There is a copy I have here of the dispatcher, which is the ILWU organ. And so one of the things that Dr. King said when he arrived, he says that I don't feel like a stranger in the midst of the ILWU. We have been strengthened and energized by the support you have given to our struggles. He noted that the civil rights movement is essentially a human rights movement, even though laws may be passed guaranteeing the right to have a job or to rent a home or to use a lunchroom. The Constitution, he noted, does not guarantee the right to have an income or to live and a decent home or to be able to buy food at an unsegregated lunch counter. He talked about the civil rights movement or the Negro freedom movement and the labor movement being one and the same. He said that the same people who oppose labor are the same people who oppose civil rights. And he also made a point of saying that we needed a radical redistribution of wealth, of power. And he believed that ordinary citizens should be able to have major input into their government. He believed in social transformation. And I think that people have been brainwashed about Dr. King in a way to make him a non-radical, to make him an individual who was not connected to the class struggle in any way. And I'd just like to call the audience's attention to this. The 1963 March on Washington, where he gave his famous I Have a Dream speech, the March on Washington was a movement that started in 1941, led by A. Philip Randolph. And so the March on Washington in 1963 was a culmination of struggle by labor. And I would, and this particular march was about jobs and freedom. And I think that some people have forgotten that Dr. King was against police brutality. He faced it. And when he and other people were out there demonstrating on the streets, the South, facing dogs and billy clubs and bayonets, he was a man who was attacked by the police. He was jailed by the police. He was brutalized by the police. He was a man who faced danger from racists and mobs. And he was a guy who had courage, you know. And so much of what he was about has been forgotten. And I would say that the focus on his civil rights advocacy, which was very important, has overshadowed his struggle for economic justice. And that was a very, very important part of his struggle. And people need to remember, because you and I do, I recall so vividly when Dr. King was assassinated, I had a Black literature class by Sonia Sanchez and was our professor. And I can remember her class being canceled because of Dr. King's assassination. But let me just say this. Dr. King represented a radicalism that was very much threatening to not only the system, but to 75% of white people in America. Folks, you and I remember, Steve, but Dr. King was a very reviled figure right before his assassination. If you remember his criticism of the Vietnam War, when he talked about racism and materialism and critiquing capitalism, even members of the civil rights community broke away from him, because he was now putting the system on trial. He was now critiquing capitalism. And this was very, very disturbing to the state as well as to corporate America and to most whites, because it made them feel very, very uneasy. And I even think that it had a lot to do with why we see today the right-wing Republicans doing such things as censoring certain books that are in the schools. They're censoring the 1619 Project. Anything that depicts the real history of America in terms of its white supremacy, systemic racism, and Jim Crow, and all of that. I remember Dr. King making a speech many years ago where he said that it was not the American, it was not the Protestant work ethic that had to do with the development of capitalism. It was the enslavement of African Americans that was the foundation of that. And so this is a man who was reviled before he passed away, before he was assassinated, and people have forgotten all about that. He was not admired at all. And so we need to be very clear about Dr. King, who he was, and what he was all about. And let me just say this to you, Steve. In 2004, the ILWU Local 10 in San Francisco initiated the Million Worker March. The Million Worker March was about the mobilization of working people and their allies to advance a people's agenda and build a movement independent of the Democratic Party. Why am I bringing this up? It is because we saw this movement as a continuation of the Poor People's Campaign, which Dr. King and the Southern Christian Leadership Organization was leading in 1968. Of course, Dr. King was killed in April, and he never lived to see the development of that movement. But we saw that as the continuation of that struggle. As a matter of fact, Sister Coretta Scott King endorsed the Million Worker March. Martin Luther King III endorsed it. And as a matter of fact, Martin Luther King III even attended the Million Worker March. But in our mission statement of the Million Worker March, we quote Dr. King in saying, 36 years ago, Martin Luther King summoned working people across America to a Poor People's March on Washington to inaugurate a war on poverty and at home. Quote, the United States is at a crossroads in history. It is critically important for us as a nation and society to choose a new path and move on with resolution and courage. He believed that it was necessary for a coalition of the white and black and people of color working class to come together and put forward a working people's agenda. And I think that that's what's missing right now, Steve. That's what's missing. And if we don't do something to put, to continue that work and to put forward a meaningful workers' agenda, independently of the Republican Democratic parties, that we are facing a civil war in this country. I believe that very, very strongly. And so when we talk about Dr. King's legacy, we have to be able to tell the whole story. When Dr. King spoke that night in 1967 at Local 10, he was made an honorary member of Local 10. And I think that it's important for people to know that Dr. King acknowledged what he had learned, what the civil rights movement had learned from the labor movement. For an example, the sit-ins, that particular strategy of sitting in at lunch counters and other venues, Dr. King said that they learned that from the United Auto Workers strike in 1937 in Flint, Michigan, where the workers took over the plant and sat. He talked about those things. Many folks are aware that Dr. King was in Memphis, Tennessee, supporting sanitation workers who did not have medical coverage and did not have the fundamentals of what all working people should have. That's where he was assassinated. But that wasn't his only connection with the labor movement. He spoke at AFL-CIO conventions. He attended picket lines. This is a man who was very, very active. You know, people are so accustomed to seeing Dr. King in a suit and tie, but he was also a man who would put on his dungarees and overalls and would be out there in the streets with people. And we know that from the various videotapes of him being on the streets, putting his life on the line with others, challenging this system. So I think it is incumbent upon all of us to tell the real story of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King and his relevance to the struggle today. He understood that this was fundamentally a class struggle. He understood that because he saw that capitalism only served the interests of the ruling class. And so he thought that the necessities of life for all working people were sacrificed in order to provide luxuries for the few. And we cannot overlook that. We need to embrace that. And we need to also understand this, that all people who work for a living have something in common. I don't care if you're Black, white, Asian, Pacific Islander, South America, South Asia, it does not matter, because we as workers hold intrinsic value. You mentioned that I am a retired member of the ILWU, the International Longshore Warehouse Union. We are some of the most important and powerful workers in the world. Well, people might say, well, why would you say that, Clarence? Well, the global economy, the supply chain rests in our hands. Capitalism is based upon global trade. And let me just say this. Longshore workers are responsible for the loading and unloading of maritime cargo all over the world. And when we don't work, the supply chain is disrupted. That means that items that come off of a ship, which are automobiles, clothes, computers, cell phones, shoes, foods, wines, oil, agricultural products of various descriptions. And those particular commodities are then placed on trains and trucks and moved. And when longshore workers refuse or don't move that cargo, the global economy shuts down. That's the power that we have. And we also are essential workers. And so understanding that, that provides us with a great deal of leverage. And we have used that leverage over the years. I just like to call attention to that, to how we use it in 1934 when there was a West Coast maritime waterfront strike. And one of the major demands during that West Coast waterfront strike was the right for workers to have a hiring hall where they could democratically and fairly dispatch jobs and not have fake union bosses handing out jobs based on nepotism, ethnocentrism, kickbacks, and the like. And that was very, very important. And workers making that demand, they were called communists, Bolsheviks. As a matter of fact, the shipping companies at that time were called the shock troops of capitalism. And they thought that the demand for a hiring hall controlled by workers, for there to be a six-hour-a-day workday, for there to be a coast-wide agreement, they thought that was a radical idea. And the way that we were able to win those demands was through a strike. And I would also say that we had approximately 6 or 7 people who died during that West Coast waterfront strike. And in San Francisco, on July 5th, 1934, there were 2 people who died. One was a longshore worker. The other one was a Marine cook, belonged to the Marine Cooks and Stewards Union, both shot and killed by the police. And to this day, every July 5th, ILWU members shut down for 24 hours to commemorate their sacrifice as martyrs. I bring this up, Steve, because there are so many lessons that can be learned from that struggle that tie in directly to what the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King believed in. He believed that all workers had value, no matter what their color. And in this country, there's been a great deal of time and effort spent to divide workers on the basis of color, sex, sexual orientation, and even to the degree of using the term middle class as a way of making workers feel that they aren't part of the working class. I read something the other day where they had an analysis of what it is to be a middle class today. And they took various locations from across the country, New York, Chicago, and LA. And so one example was they said, if you made $57,000 in one city, if you make between $57,000 and $158,000, you're middle class. Well, let me just say this. I live here in the Bay Area, and I know that they're charging $3,000 a month for a one-bedroom apartment in Oakland and these new developments. And so even if you made $50,000 a year, you would really be hard-pressed to afford to live in a place where you had to spend $3,000 a month. So this talking about the middle class is really a way of dividing the working class based upon how much money you make or based upon the kind of work that you do.
That was Clarence Thomas, San Francisco's retired secretary treasurer of International Longshore Association, ILWU, Local 10, and Pacifica Steve Zeltzer.
Struggle is my address where pain and crack lives. Gunshots coming from sounds of blackness. Given this game with no time to practice. Born on a blacklist. Told I'm below average. A life with no cabbage. That's no money if you're from where I'm from. Funny, I just want some of your son. Dark clouds seem to follow me. Alcohol that my pops swallow bottle me. No apology, I walk with a bold on my shoulder. It's a cold war, I'm a colder soldier. Hold the same fight that made Martin Luther the king. I ain't using it for the right thing. In between lean and the fiends, hustle and the schemes. I put together pieces of a dream. I still have one.
I got a dream.
In the mirror, images of me getting much clearer. Dear self, I wrote a letter just to better my soul. If I don't express it, then forever I hold inside. I'm from a side where we out of control. Rap music and the hood play the fatherly role. My story like yours, yo, gotta be told. Trying to make it from a gangster to a godlier role. Red scrolls are stole slaves and Jewish people in cold cage. Hate has no color or age. Flip the page. Now my race became freedom. Right dreams in the dark, they far, but I can see them. I believe in heaven more than hell. Blessings more than jail. In the ghetto, let love prevail. With a story to tell, my eyes see the glory. And well, the world waiting for me to yell. I have a dream.
That was Common Dream. On January 14th, people from all over the region converged on Times Square in Midtown Manhattan to honor the true anti-war legacy of Dr. King. In the last year of his life, before he was killed by the bullet of an assassin, Dr. King was organizing throughout the country against what he described as the three evils of our society: militarism, racism, and poverty. Kai Pritzker of Breakthrough News covered the march in New York City to oppose the NATO-backed war in Ukraine and honor Dr. King's legacy of fighting against militarism.
They want to keep us on the brink of nuclear war because those are the stakes. Those are the stakes of keeping NATO around. Those are the stakes of U.S. imperialism. And those are the stakes of the war in the Ukraine. We have a right to say that if you're going to use our money, do not use it to destroy lives. Use it to build something.
As we approach the one-year anniversary of the war in Ukraine, people in the United States are growing tired of what they describe as unconditional political and financial support for Ukraine coming from Washington. U.S. aid to Ukraine now exceeds $100 billion, with the White House sending an additional $4 billion last week. Today, I'm at a demonstration in Times Square where people are calling for an end to the war and for money being spent on bombs and bullets to be redirected to the needs of the people.
When the war in Ukraine began, Western countries, under pressure from the United States, immediately pledged support for Ukraine for, quote, as long as it takes. Anyone who questioned the role of NATO in instigating the war, or the wisdom of sending advanced weapons into a war with a nuclear power, was called a Putin apologist. Politicians directed huge sums of money for Ukraine and levied massive sanctions against Russia without considering the consequences. As the war dragged on, governments began to insist that people sacrifice more and more for the Ukrainian war effort, especially as sanctions against Russian oil caused an unanticipated spike in world energy prices. Germany passed laws to ration heat, hot water, and light usage. British households faced an 80% rise in energy bills. When questioned on how the British government would address the energy crisis, then Prime Minister Boris Johnson said that British people needed to bear those costs because Ukrainians were paying for this war in blood. French President Emmanuel Macron had a similar response, calling higher prices, quote, the price of liberty, as if that's what was motivating Western powers, liberty and not geopolitics. During this time, the United States was facing the highest inflation in four decades. While workers found themselves having to choose between paying their light bill and buying groceries, the Biden administration was emptying out the national treasury for the war. Since the start of the war, the U.S. has committed over $100 billion to Ukraine, a huge portion of which is essentially a direct subsidy to weapons manufacturers who are getting paid to make weapons for Ukraine. These companies are making huge profits off the war, and they don't even try to hide it. On a call with investors, the CEO of Raytheon said, "I fully expect we're going to see some benefit from it." To put $100 billion into perspective, consider the fact that $100 billion is more than the budget of both the U.S. Department of Education and the Environmental Protection Agency. And at a time when cities across America are flooding, crucial water supplies and rivers are drying up, and schools are closing their doors due to lack of funding, Americans have just about had it with their government telling them that this war is a greater priority than their own needs.
While the United States military has $900 billion to spare on war, we have millions of people in the United States of America that do not have a place to lay their head.
That's right.
Have millions of people who can't have a decent job. What moral authority does the United States of America have to go and intervene anywhere in the world? We got enough business to take care of here.
The organizers of this march deliberately chose to hold the march on the weekend of Martin Luther King Day. In school, we're taught this sanitized version of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King as this peaceful, nonviolent guy who just wanted everyone to get along, and that when he came on the scene, everyone realized the error of their ways and embraced his message. In reality, Dr. King was a radical who was hated by much of the political establishment for his unwavering position on the Vietnam War. To King, war, poverty, and racism were triple evils that all went together. Racism is used to dehumanize the enemy and garner support for the war, and then every dollar spent on bombs and bullets becomes bread taken out of the mouths of children, homes that go unfinished, and schools that go underfunded. King famously said that the bombs in Vietnam explode at home. They destroy the hopes and possibilities for a decent America. With about half of the people living in this country today in or near poverty in an era of permanent war, the organizers of the march revived this aspect of Dr. King's forgotten legacy.
If Dr. King was alive today, he would be disgusted by what he is seeing with the United States. He died a man that was hated because he was an anti-war and a labor activist that actually helped the sanitation workers unionize before his death. So Martin Luther King would not be at all enjoying this or even being a part of this. He would actually probably be out in the streets with us or building his own movement to be anti-war, because war is disgusting and nothing good comes out of it. So it's a smack in the face to not only Martin Luther King, but to all black people in America, to be lying and thinking that this is what Martin Luther King will be agreeing with when it's not true. And all of y'all need to be ashamed of yourselves, honestly.
When Dr. King spoke out against war and racism, he wasn't treated like a hero. He became public enemy number one. Dr. King was constantly surveilled and wiretapped wherever he went. In 1964, the FBI sent an anonymous letter to Dr. King saying that they would reveal compromising information about him if he didn't commit suicide. In a 1968 memo describing the FBI's intention to, quote, prevent the rise of a black messiah who would unify black nationalist movements, King was identified alongside other prominent black revolutionaries like Kwame Ture as possible targets. Today, we look back and see that Dr. King was ahead of his time, and that he was on the right side of history and that he was demonized because of it. If Dr. King's legacy teaches us anything, it's that our heroes don't always get seen as such in the moment. Many times, they're demonized, they're slandered, they're attacked as agitators and traitors. Challenging the rich and powerful is never easy. But we don't honor Dr. King by doing what's easy and going along with the status quo. We honor him by saying what's on the side of peace and justice, even if it's unpopular.
When I came home, I had to really understand, why did I feel so bad? Why did I think that what I was being told, thank you for your service, but I didn't like hearing those words? Who did I serve? What did it do? What did it actually, was it in service to? This is the service I'm most proud of.
All right.
And this is always be proud of what you're doing out here.
People are basically vehicles to just create money, which must create more money to keep the whole thing from falling apart, which is what's happening. There is no profit under the current paradigm. In saving lives, putting balance on this planet, having justice and peace or anything else. You have to create problems to create profit.
Music by Terry Lynn Carrington, Money Jungle, originally composed by Duke Ellington. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. The drum major Instinct was delivered by Dr. King on February 4, 1968, at Riverside Church, Atlanta, Georgia. King spoke about the desire to be first, to be recognized, and to receive distinction. He said, "We are drifting there because nations are caught up with the drum major instinct. I must be first. I must be supreme. Our nation must rule the world." Dr. King said the nation in which we live is the supreme culprit. Civil rights activist and Black Studies professor Dr. M. Tangalizi Sanyika says Dr. King was a prophetic radical who elevated his voice for global transformation and justice.
Thank you very much, Sister Akua, for extending graciously this invitation for me to do a moment of sharing on this, the day that we are recognizing one of the world's greatest figures and certainly one of the greatest leaders that this country has ever produced, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. I had the pleasure of being in Washington, D.C., October 28th, 1963, that's about 60 years ago, for the delivery of the I Have a Dream speech that all of us know so very, very well. And the articulation of that dream was a bold vision for how Black people and poor people in this country could achieve justice, freedom, and democracy. And it was one that inspired significantly large numbers of African Americans, as well as people in the white community and other communities as well. However, for many people, the dream was a nightmare, and others simply awakened from that dream. And we have to understand that that speech was delivered at a particular time in Dr. King's development and his evolution. one can look at the King evolution in three phases, actually. And of course, today is his 94th birthday, which we say happy birthday to he, his staff, his family, and all other justice-loving people in the world. But I think there are three ways we can look at him. First is the early king, the local pastor, from perhaps about the 1955 period to the 1960 period, the period of the Montgomery bus boycott. He was simply being a local pastor to that community and provided helping, was asked to help provide leadership in that Montgomery bus boycott that was so successful. The second phase might be considered a middle phase, where he evolved as a civil rights, national civil rights leader. The middle king, if you would, roughly from 1960 to 1965. This was the era of the sit-ins. It was the era of the Freedom Rides. It was the era in which the Little Rock Nine took place, about the high school in Little Rock. It was also the era where he delivered the March on Washington speech, August 28, 1963. It was the era of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, Public Accommodations Act, in 1965, the era of the Voting Rights Act. But this was also the year in 1964 with eruptions in Harlem, and 1965 eruptions in Watts. I mean, street eruptions, disturbances. Some call them riots, some call them rebellions. But this was all happening in that period where Dr. King was emerging as a national civil rights leader and a prominent voice in the totality of the movement. But the third phase, which the global prophetic radical stage, the radical King stage, the later stage of his life from perhaps 66 to 68, here we see the emergence of Black Power. We see the reaching out to Malcolm X. We see the rebellions in Newark in 67, rebellions in Detroit in 67. We see his Beyond Vietnam speech in 67, where he attacked militarism, materialism, and racism. This is the period where he goes to Chicago and is attacked as he's trying to demonstrate for fair housing. This had never happened for him before. This was the period in which there was cultural affirmations taking place among Black people. We're Black and we're proud, and all those affirmations. This is the era in which African independence was taking place. This was also the period in which he began to talk about organizing a poor people's campaign, and he had been determined to be the most dangerous man in America, according to his FBI report. So this is a very different phase of Dr. King's life, the later one, the one where he matured, the one where he eventually wrote the book called Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos or Community. This was a very different kind of king from the early king that we had seen, but he was responding to the changes in his environment. And thus, that king is different from the I Have a Dream speech king, and is different from all the other kings that we have seen. Now, the conditions were worsening after the Dream speech. The conditions were worsening with unemployment, with dilapidated housing, with schools that were not educating our children, with police violence, with slow responses from our government, with racial exclusion taking place. All these things were happening that suggested that the Dream may not have been realized, that it was not being realized as fast as many people thought it was going to be after those civil rights acts were passed in 64 and 65. That was not the case. That was not happening. The country was not actually doing what people thought it was going to do. I was there at that particular time and thought so myself. But all of these contradictions in the delivery of goods and services to Black people nudged King to the left of where he had been in earlier and previous days. This was the period in which he also called for perhaps the redistribution of wealth in the country and indicated a support for democratic socialism. This is the period where he also had begun to reach out to Malcolm X, to begin communicating with him. And some think that had that happened, history would have been different. And there's a book you might read called Martin and Malcolm that James Cone wrote on this particular subject. So after the dream, there was not the presence of the progress at the level that Dr. King would have preferred, or many of us in the movement would have preferred, all of which moved him to the progressive left to argue that something different needed to happen and the country needed to change. So from the dream to the nightmare of the dream to the awakening from the dream for some people, we look at the ways in which Dr. King began to express his political views about what needed to happen in America. And you saw that through his speeches, because he was a master orator. You know that he had the dream speech in 63 that everybody remembers and everybody recites. We still have problems with its implementation, but it's still a bold vision that is relevant. Then we saw one called Remaining Awake, where he said, you know, Rip Van Winkle went to sleep for 20 years. Don't let that happen to America. The Knocking at Midnight, where he told us there was so much darkness in America, he wasn't sure that we could see anymore. That seems to be the case in the world that we're living in today. That one was in 67. There was the Beyond Vietnam speech in 67 as well. As a matter of fact, April 4th, 1967, and exactly a year before he was taken away from us. And again, I said earlier, that was the anti-militarism, materialism, and racism speech. And there was the Other America speech in 67, talking about the poverty in America. And then there was the Drum Major Instinct. That's one I'm going to come back to. That one was in 68, where he was trying to teach us what it meant to have a good life, if you would. And then that one was done on February the 4th, 1968, which was exactly 2 months before he was taken away from us. And then his very last speech, the mountaintop speech, if you would, April 3rd, the day before he passed at Mason Temple, that speech was delivered. So what has happening through these speeches is he is evolving his expressions and his articulations of his views. And so I want to take a look for a moment at how this came out in at least one of those speeches. There are many, many that we could listen to, and they're all gloriously beautiful to hear. But I want to spend a moment talking about one in particular for this presentation. And it's called The Drum Major Instinct. What Dr. King does here is he begins to use the conversation that James and John had brought to Jesus, asking him for a preferred position in his kingdom. And essentially, Jesus had to rebuke that. But instead of chastising them, he just said, yeah, oh, your priorities need to be reorganized and realized in a different kind of a way. But this whole story here, the intent is to say to us, you know, everybody likes to be first or wants to be first. People like to be applauded. People like to be recognized. People like to be distinguished. People like to be out front. People like to be seen. People like to be praised and appreciated. He said that's something that's true with all of us. But he also said, look, this can be a problem. This can lead for some people to conclude that they are superior and that other people are inferior. And he says that is what is so much of the problem with race relations in America. Feeling that you have been ordained to be on top. He said this is a problem. But he also said that greatness can come from humble service and servitude, and your priorities have to be reorganized for that to happen. In other words, he says, okay, everybody wants to be appreciated. Everybody likes to be out front, but you have to reorganize your priorities so that greatness comes from servitude, from doing something to help other human beings. He said, that is what your greatness comes from, but you have to reorganize your priorities to make that happen. Now, what he was doing in this speech was also preparing us for the articulation of his legacy. This was what I call his legacy speech, just to make sure that the world understood who he was and what he did and what was the mission that he left us with. For instance, he said, listen, here's some things I want you to remember about me when my day comes. When my time comes, don't take up a whole bunch of time, yada, yada, yada about it, so to speak. But he said, I want you to make sure you focus on these things. One, he said, make sure that somebody says that I tried to give my life serving others. I tried to give my life serving others. That was one. A second one, I tried to love and serve humanity. I tried to give radical love, affirmation unconditionally to serve humanity. And he said, love is visible when justice is present. Love is visible when justice is present. That's how he said it practically manifests itself. He wasn't just talking about this emotional thing called love, but he was saying that in public policy and institutional practices, et cetera, justice is the manifestation of love. He also said that I'd say to them that I attempted to feed the hungry, those who were hungry. In addition, that I tried to clothe the naked. I tried to feed the hungry, clothe the naked, and I tried to comfort the prisoners, feed the hungry. Clothe the naked, comfort the prisoners. Sounds so much like we still need today. Then he also said, if you must say that I was a drum major, say that I was a drum major for justice, that I was a drum major for righteousness. I was a drum major for peace. And then he said, make sure you say that I tried to be on the right side of the war. That's important because in that Beyond Vietnam speech, when he came out against that war, 72% of the American public, 77% of the American public disagreed with him about the war position and poverty. 55% of Black Americans similarly disagreed with his position. But he also said, you have to serve whether it is popular or not, because greatness comes from humble servitude. What he was trying to do was make sure that we understood everything that has happened in the body of his whole work, that his life was a life of service. And so he just finally said, look, I'm not going to have a lot of money or luxurious things to leave behind, but I will leave behind a committed life. That's what I want you to remember about me. I left behind a committed life, and I tried to bring love and justice into the world. He said, that's what all of my life work has been about, bringing justice and love. He didn't live but two more months after that, and he was taken away from us. But the night before he was taken away, he then did that mountaintop speech where he said, look, I've looked over, I've seen the promised land, and we as a people will get there, but I may not get there with you. But King must be contextualized in these three phases, early, middle, and late, where he was evolving based on the objective conditions that America had placed upon him. But in the end, he wanted to make sure that after everything had been said and done, that his legacy was understood. And that's the real meaning of that drum major instinct, where he contends we all have the drum major instinct. But he said it's got to be disciplined, priorities have to be reorganized, and we must understand that greatness can be achieved by humble servitude, that your ego should not get in the way of being an humble servant. And he's saying to us, don't let it get in the way. And look at what I tried to do with my life. I saw the things that my government did. I saw the things that my society did and did not do. And we still have poverty. We still have unemployment. We still have underdevelopment. We still have human misery. And my life has been trying to change that. And I'm going to tell you how I want to be understood when I leave here. That is the drum major instinct that says to all of us, he lived a committed life of service and justice and transformation for the entirety of humanity, particularly African Americans and poor people in the United States of America. That is the legacy that we should always remember about Martin. Yes, he was a radical prophet. He was a global voice for transformation. And he tried to love someone and help those who needed love the way for him, Jesus, who he emulated, suggested, and the way his mentor and his teacher, Dr. Howard Thurman, also suggested the mystic humanist, Dr. Thurman, and King, the personalist, in his philosophical approach to the world. That is really the meaning of the drum major instinct. And I hope that we have gained a better understanding of Dr. King's contribution to have made this country better. Happy birthday, Martin. Happy birthday, staff. Happy birthday to justice lovers everywhere. This is Baba, Dr. Imtangulizi Sanyika, saying thank you for listening.
That was esteemed Black Studies professor, civil rights activist, development planner, and global citizen, Dr. Imtangulizi Sanyika. This is Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. On the evening of April 4th, 1968, while standing on the balcony of his motel room in Memphis, Tennessee, where he was to lead a protest march with striking sanitation workers, Dr. King was assassinated by a bullet of hatred and evil because he spoke out against American apartheid, global capitalism, and militarism. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was born January 15, 1929, and he transitioned on April 4, 1968. Here's a classic piece that was composed by the great Pharoah Saunders, Leon Thomas on vocals, reminding us that Dr. King was the Prince of Peace, using the power of nonviolent action to challenge American apartheid and white supremacy. Pharoah Saunders, composer of Prince of Peace, Leon Thomas, and vocal. And that concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by Akua Holt and co-produced by Paulina Vasiliev and Steve Zeltzer. You can find this in all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD and on Facebook at COVID Race and Democracy. I've been your host, Akua Holt. Thanks for listening. Before we go, I leave you with this quote. The evils of capitalism are as real as the evils of militarism and racism. Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.